you know, always skeptical. Because as far as the services go, you know, when there are three main services of the mental health system, and that's the psychiatric drugs, restraints, and electroshock. And, you know, the people who really work in the field really think that they're doing well by
Wait a minute, Jane, are any of these subjects being discussed at this conference? I mean,
I don't know. It's going to be held from 8 in the morning to 5 p.m.
And where is it going to be held?
The Coconut Grove.
And that's down on the boardwalk?
Right.
You know, I mean, it would seem to me that this might be a nice place to do a counter demonstration of any
Well, that's the thing. We are planning one, and we're hoping to get other groups such as, you know, any other group that's interested in social rights.
Huff members are interested. I mean, at the meeting on Friday, Huff members said they wanted to be a part of it.
Good. I'd like anybody to call me at 475-7904.
475-7904. And when do you think this protest will start, and where will it be?
We hope to cover the whole day. I mean, depending on how many people are.
Huh.
And there will be things passed out from the Scientologists, who put out wonderful posters on the facts that we're trying to get across to the to the general public.
Well, I've always said the Scientologists kind of resent the competition from the psychiatrists. They want to do the brainwashing.
Since the late 60s, they've been putting out information that's telling the truth about the treatment of mental health systems, just like in Mad America. And what they do to the research specimens, the human research specimens, is crimes against humanity, and they're going on right now. And I hope that, you know, like people in PETA, P-E-T-A, ethical treatment of animals, well, the most unethical treatment of humans is occurring right now at Dominican, 7th Avenue, and, you know, who happens to be a client of the mental health system.
Do you have literature about these local abuses that you're going to be handing out?
I sure do. There was a 3-month investigation from a journalist from a local newspaper, and what was written about Harbor Hills before it changed its name to 7th is pretty clear what goes on even today.
So people can call you at 475-7904.
Right.
And you think you're going to be showing up at the crack of dawn on Monday morning? That's tomorrow morning?
Oh, I hope so.
And that's down there in the Coconut Grove, which is, I guess that's, do you have the address down there, the Coconut Grove? Because I know it's, I frankly can't even remember.
Let your fingers do the walking.
I mean, you know, I know where.
They don't even put the address. Oh, listen, if any of the listeners are interested, they do have a website, and it's www.mhsummit.org.
That's www.mhsummit.org.
Right.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember the two streets that intersect where the Coconut Grove is, because, see, some people don't, you can say the words Coconut Grove, but they got no idea where that is.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I know where it is.
Well,
you
can describe it as well as I.
What's that? Well, I don't know the name of those two streets, but if any listeners want to help me.
You're right. I hope you get lots of calls saying we want to support Psychiatric Inmates Rights Collective, Women Against Psychiatric Assault, Mad Women United. There's a lot of groups putting on this protest against.
So that's going to start at 8 o'clock. It's going to go throughout the day?
I sure hope so.
I hope that.
Now, that's my grandiose ideation.
I hope that the boardwalk Gestapo doesn't come after you. I know that as I walked back from
I was going to ask you, is there any place we cannot be? Is there any place
that we should be?
Should we be on the beach?
Wait a minute. They're going to tell you that you can't be anywhere on the other side of the tracks. My response to that has always been, if it's open to the public, we have a right to be here. provided we're not blocking traffic or
interfering. Isn't there a parking lot across from the Coconut Grove?
Well, you can try it. I mean, you can also try, you know, moving to Fresno and protesting from there. I mean, that's what Bush always does. They set up these little protest pens miles away. You want to be somewhere where the participants coming can be approached and where people who are...
Well, it's only like 50 feet away.
Well, whatever you think best. You know, I mean, obviously it's your show.
So. I don't know. I would, you know, it's the idea of having a collective, that everyone in the collective, you do things as a collective. There's right. no one big boss, that everybody gets together, they decide, you know, and if anybody disagrees, nobody does it.
Oh, well,
that's how we run PERC.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if I... If
because
I
otherwise it's voting against somebody, and that's what democracy is. It's the majority wins.
No,
and the majority has the power.
I think democracy has to do with human rights, too, and human rights are not a function of a majority vote. But I can understand how certainly an organization's actions have to be governed by...
Oh, the majority on the minority? For how many years, whenever you're labeled mentally ill, are you considered then... Upon diagnosis, subhuman, you lose all constitutional rights.
Yeah. So this is going to be both days, Monday and Tuesday, at the Coconut Grove, which is right down there at the boardwalk on whatever those two streets are.
Yeah, and, you know, I'd love somebody to call in who's really pro-mental health system.
Oh, yeah? Yeah. Well, maybe we can, you know, get Dr. Luther to give us a quick call.
Oh, that'd be great. Okay,
give a call to Jane at 475-7904 if you want to help out with this effort. Do you need help making signs and so forth?
Oh, sure. And we'll have some things down there, hopefully. But,
tomorrow
you
morning.
Know, it's nothing like the moment.
Okay. Hey, thank you very much,
Jane. Okay.
All right.
Bye.
Bye-bye. So, yeah, Jane's number again, 475-7904. That's Jane Kaiser of PERC, Psychiatric Inmates Rights Collective. And they're fighting psychiatric oppression. They're fighting, it's kind of a massive ideology, which is that there's a whole system of social control in place. It's not that people don't have real problems. It's not that people don't get dysfunctional. It's how do we set up a situation where people can actually have more chance of recovering and not less? And that's, I think, the issues. And retain their human rights throughout the process. Difficult situation. Tomorrow, the... Mental Health Summit meets. These, frankly, as I understand that, are the bureaucrats who are running these systems and likely to be locking you up and making money off of you for being locked up, and all the while convincing themselves that they're all helping you out. So you can come on down and become a part of that. I guess it's, as I understand it, all day tomorrow and all day Tuesday at the Coconut Grove, which is a sort of a large ballroom restaurant on the ocean, in the middle of the boardwalk complex down there. It's Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. Stay with us for more.
Oh, I am just a student, sir, and only want to learn. But it's hard to read through the rise and smoke from the books that you like to burn. So I'd like to make a promise, and I'd like to make a vow, that when I've got something to say, sir, I'm gonna say it now. Oh, you've given me a number, and you've taken off my name. To get around this campus, why, you almost need a plane. And you're supporting Chiang Kai-shek while I'm supporting Mao. So when I've got something to say, sir, I'm gonna say it now. I wish that you'd make up your mind, I wish that you'd decide, that I should live as freely as those who live outside. Cause we also are entitled to the rights to be endowed. And when I've got something to say, sir, I'm gonna say it now. Would you like to be my father, you'd like to be my dad, and give me kisses when I'm good and spank me when I'm bad? But since I left my parents, I've forgotten how to bow. So when I've got something to say, sir, I'm gonna say it now. And things, they might be different if I was here alone. But I've got a friend or two who no longer live at home. And we'll respect our elders just as long as they allow. That when I've got something to say, sir, I'm gonna say it now. I've read of other countries where the students take a stand. They've even helped to overthrow the leaders of the land. Now I wouldn't go so far to say we're also learning how. But when I've got something to say, sir, I'm gonna say it now. So keep right on a-talking and tell us what to do. But if nobody listens, my apologies to you. And I know that you were younger once, 'cause you sure are older now. And when I've got something to say, sir, I'm gonna say it now. So I'm just a student, sir, and only want to learn. But it's hard to read through the rising smoke from the books that you like to burn. So I'd like to make a promise, and I'd like to make a vow, that when I've got something to say, sir, I'm gonna say it now.
And it's an oldie from Phil Oakes, but still a goodie. This is Free Radio, 96.3 FM. Phone lines are open in case you wanted to call, 427-3772. We've been doing a lot of the pro-referendum stuff around the De Anza residents' attempt to, well, looks like it might be successful, but still an attempt to reverse city council's, what I call their sellout to MHC, forcing a contract, destroying rent control, and essentially gutting the equity of the seniors in order to save the city the legal expenses and possible damage settlement that they may suffer if MHC wins the case in court or through arbitration. I went to the Sentinel website this morning and got the following off. This is some, for me, it's some pretty nasty shit, but it's critical stuff, and I want to run it by you. And I'll read it. Well, thanks to all the concerned folks who tried to be innovative in their rent control scheme, the people of Santa Cruz may end up paying more than $15 million in damages and legal fees to manufactured home communities of Chicago. Santa Cruz will go back to court on rent control from today's Sentinel. That doesn't include the millions of dollars that the city will need to fight it. These costs would exist if Santa Cruz lost all the suits, which in my mind is likely. On top of that, Santa Cruz would probably also lose the suits that would be brought by the residents of De Anza for their lost equity. Great, I guess that this let's be nice gesture will cost the city more than $20 million. To put this in perspective, that is more than $350 for every man, woman, and child in the city. It's also more than 40% of the city's annual budget. But enough folks around here have signed a petition to take this back to court. Why not just cut our losses now and put together a fund to compensate the owners of the homes in De Anza for their lost equity and put this failed attempt at government control at the markets behind us? And then we have another member who responds, I have to admit that if the money is going to be spent anyway, I'd rather see it go to dispossessed local homeowners than lawyers or out-of-town corporations. But as they used to say, what a revolting development this is. Actually, I was kind of incautious in what I said earlier. This is obviously a general attack on the city's rent control law and the city council's bungling rather than necessarily on the De Anza residents. But it's a different point of view, and I'm going to read it. Pay attention, folks. There is a pattern of 1, regulation, 2, monkeying with regulation, 3, taxpayer finance bailout to mitigate the effects of the original and the monkeyed regulation, perhaps after expensive litigation, which pervades politics at all levels. Whenever people endorse the notion that government is entitled to control economic affairs in some way, and their role as voters, people with this delusion always think they're doing good or bringing order to chaos, but later in their role as taxpayers, they're always the ones to pick up the check. You would think people would get the idea after a seemingly never-ending procession of similar lessons down through the centuries, scores in the last several decades alone, but apparently not. On the bright side, I know we had to be keeping the blasted city utility tax around for some good reason, and now we finally learn how it's going to be spent. I say this because the amount quoted by Chris is similar to the amount collected per household by the utility tax in a year, according to the numbers I saw back when we were trying to repeal it. Sorry to all of you who hectored us dissenters. It's saying it's time to trust our council to manage our municipal affairs so that the money is spent wisely and to give them enough money to manage those affairs. I know you wanted the tax revenue to go for necessary social programs, but that's how it goes. I'm not mean-spirited. Really, I'm not. I've just seen too much of this kind of thing before to feel the good hype, to buy the good feel-good hype any longer. The answer is to get serious about smaller, less intrusive government that takes little in taxes and spends even less than that, leaving people alone to mind their own business unless they injure or endanger others. It's obviously a libertarian perspective here. The good hearts and creativity of the people themselves, working voluntarily or in equitable mutual exchange, are the only things that ever create and maintain a true community, and only enforceable ironclad deeds, leases, or renters' agreements after hard bargains have been driven by both sides and both have read the fine print ever really protect residents or property owners in the long haul. That never changes, although people fool themselves for a while now and then, as we appear to have done here. And that's signed JP. Here's another post. Wow, you guys are Santa Cruz residents? Not really. They're newbies saying the same thing that newbies say before they become fully acclimated. Give them another 10 years and they'll be begging to have their taxes increased. I'm not going to sign the De Anza folks' petition, nor will I vote or pay for the legal fight against MHC. But they are victims, and MHC is a villain if there ever was one. The city settlement keeps rent control for the residents. The loss of equity, if you can call it that, is a loss of, in speculation anyway, something that's always a risk. And I can't help but think that a lot of people living in beach flats probably would wish that they had it as bad as the De Anza residents. And let's see what else we got here in this sequence. If you want to go to this directly, by the way, you can go to the Sentinel website, Santa Cruz Sentinel, and then look on the right side of the screen as you go to, I guess if you click on the story by Heather Berner on De Anza. Heather Berner has a story in today's paper. I don't know if it's actually on the website, though. Usually it is. And you will find along the right side a lot of different email exchanges, and one of them has to do with rent control, and that's what this one is about. Thank you all for keeping this issue alive. I can't believe we're in this situation because of the lack of attention to one very important detail. I liken this to the affordable housing program that the city and county run, that people who have bought into a house under this program are now renting the property out after buying a second home. No oversight. It is not unique to this county. LA Times reported it widely in Orange County and Dana Point Harbor, for example. Good programs, good intentions, bad results. Maybe our generosity is going to sink us. If I was still a renter and couldn't afford the $100,000 down payment on a median-priced home in this town, and my quality of life was going to suffer for one more affordable housing program because I had to pay, I'd be real ticked off. And that's pretty much it. We got a caller. Maybe we got some comments on this Sentinel exchange. Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Robert?
Yes.
Oh, hi. It's Roxanne.
Hi, Roxanne.
Robert, hold on, I'm just turning off my radio. I don't really get... I'm really angry about all this eye for an eye stuff. And I'm really tired of the poor feeling so fucking virtuous. Well, the people in the beach class might like to have it so hard. Excuse me. These people worked hard all of their lives to get where they are, and they're not, there's nothing wrong with that. Just because they're not down and out and poor is no reason why they should not get the benefit of the city council's protection. I just think people are being so mean-spirited about this. People who are poor say, well, they got it a lot better than I do, and people who are rich don't care. I mean, these people are truly, to me, like the middle America that nobody gives a damn about. They can get on their own. They don't need social services. And so, screw them. And I'm getting very tired of the mean-spiritedness that people are handling this at. I know that it's a lovely place to live. Most of us can't afford to live there. But these people did earn their money, and now they're on their pensions. They did everything they were supposed to do in life. Why can't we protect them?
Well, of course, playing devil's advocate, the answer is...
Can you talk? I can't hear you very well, Robert.
Can you hear me now?
Not very well, but go ahead.
Huh. You could try turning on your radio slightly, perhaps.
Okay, go ahead.
Yeah. Well, on the other hand, now I can hear your buzzing.
I turned it off.
Yeah. Can you hear me now?
Yeah, just...
Yeah, okay. The you know, what about the social service programs that have to be cut so that the...
I don't believe they have to be.
Okay.
Let's just kick Sil Cirillo out of her job. I mean, I'm sorry,
Sil Cirillo, so should know, is the head of the redevelopment agency, who earns about, what, $150,000 a year?
Way too much. She's worth about maybe a tenth of that. You know, I mean, come on. We don't have the priorities in Santa Cruz. It's always going to be a social service program that gets cut. It's always going to be people fighting each other for the dollar. It's not going to be cutting where we really can afford to cut, where we really... We do not need a redevelopment agency. Get rid of them.
Well, I would like to see an alternate budget proposed that may have some of these potential cuts in it, like the elimination of the redevelopment agency, which will no doubt claim that they're getting, you know, millions and millions from other agencies and bringing money into the city. But, you know, I proposed this at the Huff meeting on Friday, that we and hopefully some people from De Anza and other people sponsor a forum on an alternate budget on changes in the city council, whole method of interacting with the community that could result in some real democracy, and the need for rent control citywide, things of this sort. And I'm still waiting for other groups to bite, but...
Well, redevelopment, just as an example, is a monster of its own. It takes money from the schools, it floats bonds in our name. We have no idea ever how much they're indebting us to, so that if a project falls through or whatever, it quietly, you know, we just pay the bill. That's all we do. And it's not just specifically them. You've talked about the police department. We've talked about a lot of areas. You know, I don't really believe that we do need 7 squad cars every time somebody sits on a bench too long. It's ridiculous. So it's not, I don't think it's a true representation at all to say that social services needs to be cut or we needed that frickin' utility tax. I mean, most of the time, city council, and quite frankly, I think there are some social services that can go. I really do. I think there's a lot of duplications. I think that there's a lot of groups that aren't doing what they set out to do. When I was living in the beach flats, what is the group that was supposedly going to prevent gangs in the beach flats? You know, they're located out on Soquel Avenue now. They kept getting funding and funding, and now they have a great big, building.
Barrios Unidos.
And they're Barrios Unidos, you know? I mean, I'm sure I would get killed for saying that, but, you know, that started out to be one thing, and it's turned into a huge bureaucracy. And, you know, they moved to the mall, they moved out of the beach flats, and now they're in some swell new buildings. I mean, the idea was to work for causes. The idea is not to grow and grow and grow and turn into something else and keep being funded. That's not the idea. And so there's a lot of social services that started out as little grassroots organizations to help. I mean, you remember the agencies that came out during the beach flats against keeping the low-cost housing for the beach flats. They were all the groups that served the Latinos, and they were against people keeping their home. There was a women's organization for women's health care, and they were all right in the pockets of the bureaucracy.
You're talking about the Dolphin Lee demolition.
Pardon?
You're talking about the Dolphin Lee and Rex Court demolitions and so-called Nueva Vista project.
And, you know, they came out telling, you know, well, you know, the people that come to us complain about their housing and something needs to be done. But truthfully, everybody complains about everything, you know.
Well, I certainly do.
I just think that social services in this town doesn't really do what it's supposed to do anyway. We could probably use a whole new revamping of everything. I mean, almost like starting over again because it's gotten ridiculous. Mm-hmm. The city council just wants to fund. They want to fund, I don't know what you call it, the old school of social services, to say they're giving money to them. Oh, we're the big social service. You know, we're the big contributors. They can't do without us. Have people fight over the few dollars they get every year and present their budgets and the reason they should get the money. But, you know, I don't see the social service agencies as being that effective.
Well, I think what we want to do now is hear from the city council. So what I'm going to do is counterpoint this with a little city council response to your vicious attack on the
position. I guess it is pretty vicious, but, you know, I see too many people who aren't getting what they need, and there's an agency set up to give it, and they're not getting it. I think transitional housing for the homeless is the biggest joke ever. I mean, if you ever want to get me started, I mean, as far as I'm concerned, Jim Narragon and all those people down there should just be put out of business.
Jim Narragon
is with... impossible people who are supposed to be getting housing.
Jim Narragon is with...
transitional housing.
Ah, okay. Well, let me, that's a subject I'm interested in, but let me postpone that for another time.
Okay, just ranting and raving here in Santa Cruz. Bye.
Bye-bye. Thank you. And, of course, it's my ranting and raving that gets priority here, or yours, if you call in at 427-3772. And while I'm waiting for your call, here's a little bit from the last city council meeting from the perspective of council member Cynthia, no union at Planned Parenthood, please, Matthews. Before we go into her, however, we have this call, which takes priority. Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Sorry, radio was on. So all this argument coming from the people that really don't care about the people over in De Anza, I think you should ask them what they think about repealing Proposition 13, and you'll hear their arguments flip 180.
Proposition 13, of course, is a proposition that keeps property taxes way down.
Way down. Even Warren Buffett, Mr. Pro-capitalist, expert in the field, lots and lots of money there, even he thinks it's a stupid idea, and, you know, Arnie kicked him off his campaign once that came out.
So, yeah, you're pointing out a contradiction. Okay. Any other point you want to make?
That's it.
Hey, thank you. Bye-bye. All right, let's hear from some more of those pro-council. Well, actually, here's the council itself speaking. As I mentioned, Cynthia Matthews is speaking now on October 7th at the council meeting.
We went to recess, and I was asking her if she had heard anything during the public comment that raised any questions that she wanted to either speak to or ask the advice of our council.
Well, a number of issues were raised, and I will ask some of them now, give others a chance, and then may have some others left over. One of the questions raised was hiring outside attorneys, and I would just like our attorneys to comment on the relative cost of that, the implications, and another question which was raised was setting some kind of limit on the amount that we might pay for litigating this case. So that general issue of bringing in additional attorneys and setting a cap.
As far as bringing in additional attorneys, certainly your prerogative. The rate you're paying us currently is $150 an hour, and I don't believe you're going to bring in outside counsel for a rate under $200 to $250 an hour. But we can explore that if you give us direction. The startup cost, we've been with this for quite a long time now, since the outset, and the amount of records and things that would need to be reviewed would be substantial, so I think it would be substantial startup costs for an outside law firm if he decided to change legal representation at this particular juncture. And I can't imagine it being less expensive to litigate. That's my reaction to that. What was the second half of your question?
Setting a cap on the amount that we might allocate towards pursuing the case.
Well, we are able to a certain extent to control costs, but in many respects, the costs are dictated by the other side, by the amount of discovery that's requested. They've noticed, for example, in the past depositions in Washington, D.C., of former city officials that are residing back there. It would be very difficult for us to, as your legal representatives, we have an ethical obligation to fervently and aggressively represent our clients' interests, and it would be an uncomfortable position for us to be in to say that you can spend so much money on the defense of a lawsuit despite what, you know, what at that particular time, you know, a good defense requires, and expect us ethically to do what we feel is best. So it would be, you know, we are always very cost conscious, and we try to watch out. We're very conscious of the city's overall budget situation because we represent the city in all aspects of the city operations on a daily basis, so we're quite familiar with the constraints you're operating under. On the other hand, to ask us to, you know, unreasonably cut corners when we're compromising, when that would effectively be compromising your defensive position, and the ramifications of that in terms of an adverse result may be, you know, penny wise and pound foolish in the outcomes.
I would like to just add that the other thing you need to consider is you have a 6-month window between now and the actual trial, and that would present a real substantial hurdle for a new firm coming in under those circumstances. And typically a firm would do that and want a continuance, but the agreement is what the agreement is. Sets the date.
Okay. There was another statement that insurance should cover more costs than were described. I wonder if you could again go over the nature of the city's legal insurance.
Yeah, I wonder, before we go to that question, we had a follow-up on the first.
Sure.
Do we know, do we have any idea what MHC costs are running us, like, on an hourly basis? If, should we be responsible for paying those fees? Do they put us on notice what those costs are?
No. I mean, not formally on notice, but what we did learn is that they charge $810,000 an hour.
Thank you. Okay, continue, Cynthia.
That's more than I thought it was hard.
You know, there's a reaction from the audience. We have no control over their charges, and if damages are awarded, that's what it is. Yeah. The fees. And related to that, there was, again, the statement that our insurance should cover more costs than were described. So I wonder if you could review again the nature of the city's liability insurance, both for this immediate and for future litigation.
The city does have the policy that was in effect at the time the claims were filed. It will arguably should cover the city's costs of defense, the city's own legal costs, and any damages awarded against the city. We have, those policies have a $500,000 deductible, and there's a dispute between the city and its insurance carrier about how many deductibles apply. We've retained separate legal counsel who specializes in insurance affairs. We've made a demand for payment, and we expect that we will probably need to file litigation against our insurance carrier before that issue is resolved. So I think in the end we will have, you know, substantial insurance coverage. What that time frame will be, or who will prevail and how many different deductibles apply to the 11 causes of action, I think it's risky to forecast. But we think the city has a strong position there, but it's not a short-term proposition. We know how long these things take. And the major financial risk is in the attorney's fees award side of this situation.
And I would add that you're not entitled to recover your attorney's fees for pursuing your contractual rights under your insurance agreement. So whatever those costs would be to sue or get the money from your insurance
agreement, George Kovacevic, Assistant City Attorney speaking.
Regardless of the outcome of your claim against the insurance company.
There was a suggestion. De Anza through eminent domain. Can you comment on that?
It's hard to know where to begin. I mean, this is all about what the value of the supremacies might be, and where that kind of dollar figure comes from. I don't remember off the top of my head what the total value was that was asserted by MHC at the first settlement effort. So it's a very substantial number, and that the way the process works, ultimately, a court would probably decide what the value is. Then you're obliged to come up with it somehow, it seems.
Manager Dick Wilson speaking.
Yeah, the best of all possible worlds, starting from a whole new beginning years and years ago. Perhaps that might have been not, but at this point, I don't know how you ever get to that kind of a conclusion.
Tony, did you have a comment?
No, Mr. Wilson.
Thank you. There was a comment that the people of Santa Cruz want to support this case, not just support the referendum, but support the cost of pursuing it. And I know there is a city revenue committee, on which I do not sit. I wonder if anyone on that committee could give a sense of the relative possibilities. Maybe you think it's premature at this point, but the relative amounts are being discussed.
Well, it's council members Fitzmaurice, Porter, and myself, and we are looking at seven different possible taxes, each of which would require going to the voters for approval, whether it be a 50% or two-thirds vote. We're still discussing. We're looking at a projected deficit for the coming year of this current year of $2 million. And as city manager said, any number of things that could alter that. Most of them, or all of them, that we're aware of increasing the amount of the deficit. And we're having a public meeting on October 21st, I believe. Let me make sure. We're going to have a public meeting on October 21st. When we will, at 7 o'clock in council chambers, Tuesday, October 21st, where we'll go over a public survey that was done about public support for each of these seven potential revenue sources. And I think it'll demonstrate that even by the most optimistic scenario in terms of public support, that it would be significantly short of being able to address the $2 million deficit. We'd be lucky to be able to get voter support for a million or maybe a million two or something optimistically. So when I look at the chart of potential taxes, apparent levels of voter support, it seems to me that there's no way that the revenues that will be bringing forward proposals to the council could possibly close the gap between current projected revenues and expenses, the gap of $2 million. We'd be lucky to cut that in half. And given what happened today in terms of the vote, pledges by Schwarzenegger and others to rescind the vehicle license fee, we have no idea if they're going to vote some kind of referendum, try to qualify a referendum on that. I think we all understand that the gap would be significantly larger than that. So I'd encourage people to plan to watch or come on October 21st when we'll have a full airing. That'll also be a chance for people to present to the committee their own ideas of generating revenue in the city, and we'll have a report and discussion of the surveys that we've done and how what it looks like in terms of public support.
Thank you, Scott. Tim?
Well, I just join all those comments. The fact is we're not looking at anywhere near the amount of money that we would need solve this problem, this particular litigation problem. But we also have results of surveys that will be released to the public that show that the public isn't all that enthusiastic, even when presented with real with goals that maybe they haven't been presented with this one, but presented with goals that they would find admirable to vote themselves an increase in taxes. So we're up against it when it comes to figuring out how to increase revenues. We'll be talking about that in the 21st, and as Scott suggested, what's really happening in the 21st, that's where we want other people's ideas, because we haven't come to any conclusion at all about where we're going to go on this matter. But in this matter predates the decision on the referendum, as a matter of fact, and that will be included in our subsequent discussions in the Revenue Committee to understand what our future revenue needs are going to be. And so then we'll have a meeting after the 21st where we'll actually do more of the talking, but hopefully people will come on the 21st and help us to understand what they think we might do to solve this problem.
Thanks. Another issue was raised by several speakers questioning why the De Anza residents, why it's not appropriate for the De Anza residents to either why they can't legally be considered a party of interest for the suit, or why they can't join in the city's suit. So I wonder if the attorneys could go over that issue again.
The question is whether they're an indispensable party, and I think in the procedure would have been to make a motion to intervene during the pendency of the litigation.
You put that in plain language.
Well, they if they wanted to join into the lawsuit sometime during the lawsuits have been on file for quite a long time, and at no point did they make a motion or to the court to intervene and to become a participant in the lawsuit. And it's questionable at this late juncture, especially after the judge has gone through all of the mediation and settlement proceedings that went before that, at this late juncture, that the court would favorably consider such a motion. So the timing of the motion is one aspect, and then George addressed, you know, whether even if the judge dismissed the timing of a motion to intervene at this time, whether the judge would find that there's adequate legal grounds for intervention on the basis that the tenants, the ordinance is being applied, is an as-applied challenge to the ordinance currently. So the actual validity of the ordinance is not at stake in this particular lawsuit at this juncture. So the outcome of the lawsuit is not going to be repeal of the ordinance. The ordinance will be on the books. The outcome of the lawsuit from MHC's perspective will be successful if they receive an award of damages and attorney's fees, but the ordinance will remain in place. Now, if the second lawsuit comes forward and they file a facial challenge in the subsequent lawsuit, maybe that will provide a scenario for the tenants to intervene and have their interests represented. But at this juncture, we think probably the timing of a motion to intervene would not be looked upon favorably by the court, and even if the court got by that on the merits, you know, the legal basis for intervening, it would be received favorably.
I would have to ask a question on the back of that. Go ahead, George.
The court has issued an order closing the case, so I just don't see any way the court would entertain that at this point. In the event that litigation is reinstituted, then there might be another open here, assuming you can prove if we have standing, which I think is questionable.
And Cynthia, do you mind if I ask a question
on
the back of that?
Mike probably had a related one, too.
Okay. I just wondered if if that motion to request to intervene motion to request standing in the lawsuit were to be made, what my understanding is, if I understood you correctly, that we wouldn't make that request anyway. It would be the homeowners who would make that request. Is that right?
That's correct.
Okay. Mike.
Yeah, I just want to point out that because the way this was sort of put forward and the answer, you know, that our attorneys are answering this question, make it sound like the city is the group that's objecting to the tenants being a party here. Just to be clear that we're not the ones that objected to it in the past. In fact, when we were in the settlement agreement with the judge in San Jose, both Scott Scott Kennedy and Ed Porter both raised the question of why the tenants weren't present and involved. They had interests and so forth, and the judge said it's not appropriate for them to be there. So it's not, I don't think in the end it's up to us. It may be that those individuals who thought that the homeowner should be involved as a party or something may have, you know, some correct view here. Don't take our attorney's word for it. If you think you have potential action, get involved and do something about it. But I don't think we want to be placed in a position that somehow we're the ones that objected to the third party being involved. We never objected to it. It was never raised, except when we raised it with the judge in the settlement. He said it's not appropriate. I'm settling the case between two parties, and this is what I'm about today. So I don't think there's an issue beyond that for us. The tenants may have interests that they, as was said, if the suit starts up again, they may have rights and concerns that they'll express.
Thank you, Mike. I have one more legal defense cost question, and that was one of the things that was raised was the defense cost estimates if the homeowner sued the city, and why we hadn't addressed that in our list of what costs might be.
Well, I think it's just absolutely premature in the sense of trying to analyze something that we don't even see or know exist, except I would say that for liability purposes, it may be more of a matter of a law question as opposed to
There was a question about who would actually write the language of the ballot description.
I would. I mean, once it qualifies for the ballot, the city clerk would refer to my office. Be basically just composing the question to be put to the voters, and it would be fairly reflective, I assume, of what's on the referendum petition, concise summary of that. I haven't seen a referendum petition myself.
And the ballot description is different than ballot arguments.
Yeah.
I just want to make that statement.
Yes.
And would there be ballot arguments and legislative analysis the way there is on state initiatives and ballot things?
Yeah, it would be similar to the initiatives, but proponents and opponents of the measure are the ones who prepare the arguments, and that our office doesn't do that.
Right. Ed?
But my question was, you would prepare what's known as an impartial analysis and a fiscal impact.
I don't do fiscal impact reports. When the initiative process, if the council wants that, they direct the finance director or the city manager to prepare that, and I don't know if that corresponds to the referendum process or not. I'd have to look that up, but I can get an answer for you.
Okay. And then just tell me if I'm correct about this. The arguments in favor of and against the city clerk solicits parties to, the city clerk consolidates various parties, if there's more than one, into one group of proponents and one group of opponents.
If there are multiple groups that wish to prepare the arguments, the government code has a priority list that who goes to the top of the list and who doesn't, you know, who goes second, things of that nature. So it's all spelled out in the government code, but there's only one argument in favor, one argument in opposition.
And you're listening to a very bad tape, or maybe it's a bad transmission process here in the studio, of the video of the Santa Cruz City Council meeting, a special meeting of October 7th, where the City Council did its apologetics and, as I call it, its bitching and whining session. Some would say simply they raised the issue of the De Anza referendum without bringing up any significant new information around budget priorities. You note that Kennedy mentioned there is a meeting of the Revenue Committee public hearing, even though it's been meeting secretly and in private for two and a half months now. The public has not been invited even to observe this process. Suddenly they're going to come up with their special, the poll, the survey of the seven taxes. I'd certainly be interested in seeing that, but my question is, why hasn't this print been transparent and open to the public all along? And the answer is because Scott Kennedy and Mike Rotkin don't want it to be. And similarly, the city council goes along with this behind-closed-doors nonsense. I guess they're afraid of me and my tape recorder. Who knows what they're afraid of? I don't know. a lot of the questions that Barisoni, the city attorney, and the other assistant city attorneys were answering are kind of irrelevant, like the ballot arguments, because this is never going to get to the ballot. Once the referendum is signed into, certified to go on the ballot, the city council will move to short-circuit it by rescinding the law. There's absolutely no percentage whatsoever for them to hold a special election for this, since the very existence of the thing, when the referendum succeeds in putting it on the ballot, that kills the settlement, even before the public votes. And that's the big point that the city council kept making, and claiming that the ends of people were not properly informing the citizenry, that it isn't just putting it on the ballot, it's killing the settlement. Yes, it is killing the settlement once the signatures are turned in, because MHC has required that the settlement be instituted by a certain date and so forth, and this stalls it until the election, which can't be held for a number of months at the earliest. So there won't be an election. All this stuff about ballot measures and descriptions of ballot measures are really kind of not to the point. What is to the point is the kind of evasiveness and vagueness that the city manager and the city attorney gave us in trying to answer some rather important questions, like how much will the liability be? Oh, I couldn't possibly say. What about the eminent domain? I have no idea. I mean, the kinds of answers, and then Cynthia Matthews, instead of saying, what do you mean you have no idea? We're paying you $150,000 a year. What do you mean you don't have? Come on, let's get some specifics here. Matthews, like the little, I know I'm accused of ad hominem arguments against Matthews, but she really strikes me as being completely servile to these staff in not challenging them and saying, come on, let's get some actual facts here. You know, the city is paying you a huge amount of money. We're asking you relevant questions. You've had, many, many months to look over these questions. They're not new questions. Why don't we have some answers? And we don't. Not from the staff, at least not in this particular section of the tape, which I wasn't able to listen to, by the way, all the time, because I got a phone call during that time. But nonetheless, that's kind of my take on some of it. Wilson did claim that the city has great substantial insurance coverage for a lot of this stuff, except for attorney's fees, which would seem to indicate that the supposed costs of the millions and millions of dollars might be covered by insurance. That was what I got out of his answer, but I'm not really clear either, because, again, we're getting these contradictory signals from the city council and the city manager on what's going on here. We don't have straight information, and we need it. Maybe we should all, rush the city council on October 23rd? Is that the date he said? October 21st at 7 p.m. is the city council meeting. There's also a city council meeting coming up, as you know, in 2 days, the regular city council meeting. This next one's going to be a special council meeting. I also note things like they ran around the bushes on the issue of, well, you can't have De Anza and Clearview Court people in there because they're not really party to the suit, and then that would be objected to. But the real question is, I suspect the De Anza people, I'd like them to come forward on this, asked to know what was going on behind closed doors. And I suspect if the city wanted to, they could have advised them, look, what you need to do is intervene as a party of interest at a fairly early stage. And I imagine the question was put at a fairly early stage, since this issue did involve them, although maybe I'm wrong. Maybe De Anza was completely asleep at the wheel. I don't think so. A year ago, they were fighting this issue at city council, and I think this issue has been fought continually. I suspect we're getting these after-the-fact rationalizations and sort of cover answers by the city manager and city attorneys when they could have helped the De Anza residents to become a part of the lawsuit or encouraged them, but in fact simply didn't or else excluded them. It's very nice that Kennedy and Porter at the last settlement meeting requested the De Anza people be present. My question is, why didn't they do it at the first one? Maybe they did. Scott and Ed, call in and let us know what the story is. I made some requests about Ed Porter by phone recently. Ed's still refusing to return my phone calls. These council members, even the ones who are on your side in this issue, are so prickly and so arrogant at some particular level, I notice, that they don't answer simple questions from the public for people they don't like. And it's just wrong. It's just a mistake. And it's part of this whole bad process. And maybe we would have to mandate that city council members will return their calls. I don't know. It's hard to say. Anyway, maybe that's what we need. got an email from Becky Johnson. She requested me to read these comments and commentary, and since she made this request back on Thursday and I didn't do it, I'm going to have to do it today or really get massive flack from Becky. And there's some good thoughts here. I want to bring it to your attention. Robert, here are some ideas for revenue sources for the city of Santa Cruz to get the money to fight MHC and save our seniors. If a special assessment district is formed, which charges each resident, Deanza and Clearview Court, paid $100 per month, that would raise $26,500 per month. 4 months of such an assessment would pay for 1 month of litigation if it rises to the unlikely cost of $100,000 per month, as City Manager Dick Wilson reported but did not explain. The golf course could be sold. It is owned by the city. It is a break-even facility, so it doesn't even provide revenue to the city. If it were sold to a private entrepreneur, the citizens could still golf, so there would be virtually no loss to the citizens of Santa Cruz other than a paper loss. Scott Kennedy has argued in favor of the golf course because the city is able to offer golfing fees for less than the market rate. I think the city should stop subsidizing golfers and start protecting its seniors and its affordable housing. Since every infraction ticket costs the city an average of $1,000 each, we could save money by legalizing hopscotch. The Santa Cruz Police Department is writing 16 tickets a year for chalking on the sidewalk. If we legalize sidewalk chalk on public sidewalks, the city could save $16,000 in police court and jail costs. One less police officer saves the city about $100,000 per year. The redevelopment agency costs us $5,261,000 per year with five full-time city workers, including a director, a manager, and a project coordinator, along with two assistants. Cut the three managers, keep the two workers, who probably do all the work anyway, and we can save plenty. The budget, for some reason, doesn't say what the workers are paid. The RDA, Redevelopment Agency, was established to help the city of Santa Cruz recover from the 89 earthquake 14 years ago. We should keep a greatly reduced agency to garner certain funds, but a full-blown agency with five full-time paid staff, many services which are duplicated by the planning department, is a total waste of our money. And her figure about 16 tickets per year for chalking on the sidewalk is based on discovery provided by the Santa Cruz Police Department of citations issued between January 2000 and August 2002 in the chalk on the sidewalk go to jail trial of Tim Rinker and Becky Johnson, her own trial. So thanks, Becky, for that email. On a different subject, today is, well, what? Indigenous Peoples Day, Columbus Day. This is the day that is celebrated, I suppose, in many public functions and denounced in many others. I want to read a selection that I read, I think, a year or two ago from James W. Lowen, Lies My Teacher Told Me, Everything Your American History Textbook Got Wrong. And in a way, this is in kind of a memoriam to people who have fought to expose the mythology of Columbus and to actually let people know it really happened. I mean, there's sort of some vague statements people occasionally make. Oh, Columbus, well, you know, he helped to kill the Indians, and he initiated the Europeanization and the eventual extinction of the Arawaks, the first peoples that Columbus encountered on the island of Hispaniola. But in fact, the details are very grim and very gruesome and actually apparently historically pretty well established. And that was the reason that my old associate James Costner went in a couple years ago and smashed the Columbus statue at San Jose City Hall with a sledgehammer, just destroyed it, and is now and served a significant amount of time in jail awaiting trial, and then had a huge restitution he has to pay. And while I did not agree with that action as a politically effective way of bringing things about, and I felt it got a lot of people involved that didn't want to get involved, felt they had to because of loyalty to him, I think that one has to understand the kind of hostility that Columbus properly generates. I'm going to read a little bit from this book. Christopher Columbus introduced two phenomena that revolutionized race relations and transformed the modern world: the taking of land, wealth, and labor from indigenous peoples, leading to their near extermination, and the transatlantic slave trade, which created a racial underclass. Columbus's initial impression of the Arawaks, who inhabited most of the lands in the Caribbean, was quite favorable. He wrote in his journal on October 13, 1492, "At daybreak, great multitudes of men came to the shore, all young and of fine shapes and very handsome. Their hair was not curly, but loose and coarse like horsehair. All have foreheads much broader than any people I had hitherto seen. Their eyes are large and very beautiful.
They are not black, but the color of the inhabitants of the Canaries. This reference to the Canaries was ominous, for Spain was then in the process of exterminating the aboriginal people of those islands. Columbus went on to describe the Arawak's canoes, some large enough to contain 40 or 50 men. Finally, he got down to business. I was very attentive to them and strove to learn if they had any gold. Seeing some of them with little bits of metal hanging at their noses, I gathered from them by signs that by going southward or steering round the island in that direction, there would be found a king who possessed great cups full of gold. At dawn the next day, Columbus sailed to the other side of the island, probably one of the Bahamas, and saw two or three villages. He ended his description of them with these menacing words. I could conquer the whole of them with 50 men and govern them as I pleased. On his first voyage, Columbus kidnapped some 10 to 25 Indians and took them back with him to Spain. Only 7 or 8 of the Indians arrived alive, but along with the parrots, gold trinkets, and other exotica, they caused quite a stir in Seville. Ferdinand and Isabella provided Columbus with 17 ships, 1,200 to 1,500 men, cannons, crossbows, guns, cavalry, and attack dogs for a second voyage. One way to visualize what happened next is with the help of the famous science fiction story, War of the Worlds. H.G. Wells intended his tale of Earthlings' encounter with technologically advanced aliens as an allegory. His frightened British commoners, New Jerseyites in Orson Welles' radio adaptation, were analogous to the primitive peoples of the Canaries or America, primitive in quotes. And his terrifying aliens represented the technologically advanced Europeans. How many people know that about this H.G. Wells story? I didn't. As we identify with the helpless Earthlings, Wells wanted us also to sympathize with the natives on Haiti in 1493, or in Australia in 1788, or in the upper Amazon jungle in the 1990s. When Columbus and his men returned to Haiti in 1493, they demanded food, gold, spun cotton, whatever the Indians had that they wanted, including sex with their women. To ensure cooperation, Columbus used punishment by example. When an Indian committed even a minor offense, the Spanish cut off his ears or nose. Disfigured, the person was sent back to his village as living evidence of the brutality the Spaniards were capable of. After a while, the Indians had had enough. At first, their resistance was mostly passive. They refused to plant food for the Spanish to take. They abandoned towns near the Spanish settlements. Finally, the Arawaks fought back. Their sticks and stones were no more effective against the armed and clothed Spanish, however, than the Earthlings' rifles against the aliens' death rays in War of the Worlds. The attempts at resistance gave Columbus an excuse to make war. On March 24, 1495, he set out to conquer the Arawaks. Bartolomé de las Casas describes the force Columbus assembled to put down the rebellion. Since the admiral perceived that daily the people of the land were taking up arms, ridiculous weapons in reality, he hastened to proceed to the country and disperse and subdue by force of arms the peoples of the entire island. For this he chose 200 foot soldiers and 20 cavalry with many crossbows and small cannon, lances and swords, and a still more terrible weapon against the Indians in addition to the horses. This was 20 hunting dogs who were turned loose and immediately tore the Indians apart. Naturally, the Spanish won. According to Kirkpatrick Sale, who quotes Ferdinand Columbus's biography of his father, the soldiers mowed down dozens with point-blank volleys, loosed the dogs to rip open limbs and bellies, chased fleeing Indians into the bush to skewer them on sword and pike, and with God's aid, soon gained a complete victory, killing many Indians and capturing others who were also killed. Having as yet found no fields of gold, Columbus had to return some kind of dividend to Spain. In 1495, the Spanish on Haiti initiated a great slave raid. They rounded up 1,500 Arawaks, then selected the 500 best specimens, of whom 200 would die en route to Spain. Another 500 were chosen as slaves for the Spaniards, staying on the island. The rest were released. A Spanish eyewitness described the event. Among them were many women who had infants at the breast. They, in order to better to escape us, since they were afraid we would turn to catch them again, left their infants anywhere on the ground and started to flee like desperate people. And some fled so far they were removed from our settlement of Isabella 7 or 8 days beyond mountains and across huge rivers, wherefore from now on scarcely any will be had. Columbus was excited. In the name of the Holy Trinity, we can send from here all the slaves in Brazil which could be sold, he wrote to Ferdinand and Isabella in 1496. In Castile, Portugal, Aragon, and the Canary Islands, they need many slaves. I do not think they can get enough from Guinea. He viewed the Indian death rate optimistically. Although they die now, they will not always die. The Negroes and Canary Islanders died at first. Someone was trying to call in during this reading. If you want to try and call back in about 2 or 3 minutes, I'll answer your call. I'm going to quite finish the selection, and then I'm going to answer the call. In the words of Hans Koenig, there now began a reign of terror in Hispaniola. Spaniards hunted Indians for sport and murdered them for dog food. Columbus, upset because he could not locate the gold he was certain was on the island, set up a tribute system. Ferdinand Columbus described how it worked. The Indians all promised to pay tribute to the Catholic sovereigns every 3 months as follows. In the Cibao, where the gold mines were, every person of 14 years of age or upward was to pay a large hawk's bell of gold dust. All others were each to pay 25 pounds of cotton. Whenever an Indian delivered his tribute, he was to receive a brass or copper token, which he must wear about his neck as proof that he had made his payment. Any Indian found without such a token was to be punished. With a fresh token, an Indian was safe for 3 months, much of which time would be devoted to collecting more gold. Columbus's son neglected to mention how the Spanish punished those whose tokens had expired. They cut off their hands. All of these gruesome facts are available in primary sources material, letters by Columbus and by other members of his expedition, and the work of Las Casas, the first great historian of the Americas, who relied on primary materials and helped preserve them. I have quoted a few primary sources in this chapter. Most textbooks make no use of the primary sources. The tribute system eventually broke down because what it demanded was impossible. To replace it, Columbus installed the encomienda system, in which he granted or commended entire Indian villages to individual colonists or groups of colonists. Since it was not called slavery, this forced labor system escaped the moral censure that slavery received. Following Columbus's example, Spain made the encomienda system official policy on Haiti in 1502. Other conquistadors subsequently introduced it to Mexico, Peru, and Florida. The tribute and encomienda systems caused incredible depopulation. On Haiti, the colonists made the Indians mine gold for them, raise Spanish food, and even carry them everywhere they went. The Indians couldn't stand it. Pedro de Cordoba wrote in a letter to King Ferdinand in 1517, "As a result of the sufferings and hard labor they endured, the Indians chose and have chosen suicide. Occasionally 100 have committed mass suicide. The women exhausted by labor have shunned conception and childbirth. Many, when pregnant, have taken something to abort and have aborted. Others, after delivery, have killed their own children with their own hands so as not to leave them in such oppressive slavery." Beyond acts of individual cruelty, the Spanish disrupted the Indian ecosystem and culture. Forcing Indians to work in mines rather than in their gardens led to widespread malnutrition. The intrusion of rabbits and livestock caused further ecological damage. Diseases new to the Indians played a role, although smallpox, usually the big killer, did not appear on the island until 1516. Some of the Indians tried fleeing to Cuba, but the Spanish soon followed them there. Estimates of Haiti's pre-Columbian population range as high as 8 million people. When Christopher Columbus returned to Spain, he left his brother Bartholomew in charge of the island. Bartholomew took a census of Indian adults in 1496 and came up with 1,100,000. The Spanish did not count children under 14 and could not count Arawaks who had escaped into the mountains. Kirkpatrick Sale estimates that a more accurate total would probably be in the neighborhood of 3 million. By 1516, according to Benjamin Keene, thanks to the sinister Indian slave trade and labor policies initiated by Columbus, only some 12,000 remained. Las Casas tells us that fewer than 200 were alive in 1542. By 1555, they were all gone. And that's Lies My Teacher Told Me, Everything Your American History Textbook Got Wrong by James W. Lowen. I recommend it, Lowen. Great book. Sorry, caller, please, or callers, please try to call back, 427-3772. We'll get back to what we were talking about before, Dianza and the other issues that we usually cover on this show. You're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. I'm Robert Norse, and I'm waiting for any calls that you may be sending my way. You can also catch me on the internet. Email in whatever thoughts you have at rnorse2@hotmail.com.
Here's a younger person with a sign. Please sign our petition. Help save the homes of seniors, the disabled, and low-income workers. What is your name?
Charity.
And Charity, what does this mean? What are you carrying this sign around for?
So we can get petition signed.
What kind of petitions are these?
Petitions to help the seniors get back the mobile home park.
And how successful have you been?
We got 120-something today.
Today, 120? How many hours did you work?
Like, 5.
Are you getting coaching over here from this woman who's standing to your left here?
No, but she's my aunt.
And what's your name?
I'm Patty Pitts.
Patty, I remember it's the Pitts,
yeah,
as I remember.
Yeah, exactly.
And you, you're out trying to rein in the renegade city council?
Yeah, I don't know. I think we're going to do more than rein them in. I hope we get rid of them.
Well, are you suggesting our city council needs to be recalled? Certainly you don't want
to. You know what? I would go as far to say they need to be impeached.
Except for Ed Porter.
Oh, there you go. There you go, see? And that's without any coaching. She knows the facts. Maybe I'll be really controversial saying that, but I don't care.
I've actually called for the recall of these council members repeatedly, but so far I'm merely a voice in the wilderness. And of course, obviously, my propaganda seems to have taken hold in young, impressionable, and older impressionable minds.
Yeah, well, actually, I gotta admit, I hadn't heard that from you, but I think it's in a lot of our minds right now, and I'm hearing it from a lot of people out in Santa Cruz. When we get these signatures, people are disgusted with what they're doing. That's what they're telling us. How dare they? We know it's important for people to come before buildings.
You're here. Thank you, and we've been talking with?
I'm going to say speech to them tonight.
I hope you do.
I will.
And your name again?
Jody Barben.
Patricia Pitts.
Thanks, Jody, Patricia. We're talking with?
Craig Schindler.
And Craig, what brings you to this neck of the belly of the beast?
My mother has a mobile home at De Anza Park, number 120.
Not for long, she doesn't.
Well, you know, she even if she gets to keep it under this lease that the city negotiated without participation on the part of the mobile home parks, the lease itself is unbelievable. Like, if she has someone stay more than 3 nights, they have to pay $15 a night rent. And there are all these kinds of grounds for her being ejected from the park. It's a kind of servitude. It's a kind of corporate servitude that the city has actually created for its seniors. The worst part of it, though, is that my father's entire savings are in that mobile home park that they put in there. They trusted me when they moved here to this city. I told them they could rely on Santa Cruz, rely on the progressive spirit. This was a different kind of place, I said. They trusted the irrevocable rent control and invested their entire amount of money that they sold their home for in Sioux City, Iowa. Now, that money in a condo would have doubled or tripled right now in Santa Cruz. As it is, according to what the city council has just done, if this continues to last, they will be stripped entirely of their equity. That mobile home will be worth essentially nothing, perhaps the value of the coach, because MHC is the sole arbiter of what the fair market value is. So when MHC says it's rents at $3,000 a month, my mother and all these other seniors have something that they cannot sell. So the referendum is essential, and the referendum is not to embarrass the city council. It's to say to the city council, look, folks, you got to try harder. There is a win-win outcome here where you can find a way to protect the interests of the city and protect the affordable housing and the seniors. You cannot strip people of their entire equity. That doesn't happen in America. As a Jewish woman at the park said to me the other day, this feels like fascism when people do this to you. And I don't often use that word, but it's certainly not a democratic process that's going on here. So the referendum is essential, and then the city council needs to find a way to stand up to MHC and protect.
Don't. Maybe the community will find a way in spite of the city council.
Absolutely. We've got to. What choice is there? These people, they're up against it. This is their lives.
We've been talking with
Craig Schindler.
Thanks, Craig.
Thank you.
Anything you want to add?
Just how important it is for people to realize that this is not just about seniors, that if it can be done to one set of people, it can be done to any set of people. The way that totalitarianism spread in the 30s was that they came after one set of people and no one stood up to protest, and then they came after another and no one stood up to protest, and finally through various forms of intimidation and power, the bullies, if you will, can take over. And here we have a situation of corporate bullyhood that we see in Enron, we see in WorldCom, we see in all these different situations, and only right now it's right here in Santa Cruz, and Santa Cruz of all places needs to make a stand to stop it.
Thanks, Craig.
About 8 o'clock, Santa Cruz City Council meeting is starting. There is no police officer here. Mayor Riley is introducing the meeting.
Thank you. And you're on Free Radio.
Hi, Free Radio. This is Robert. This is Paul again.
Hey, Paul.
I just wanted to respond to something from a few calls back and from before the Columbus Day reading, and thank you for that. It's good to be reminded about what today is. A caller mentioned Proposition 13, and this is something that keeps coming up in local debate. Is it okay to say a word or two about that?
Sure. Go ahead.
Okay. I call Proposition 13 property tax control, similar to what rent control would be if we had it for everybody. I think that if we cannot go with, if we can't have, universal statewide rent control, then, maybe we need to look at doing something about Proposition 13 for homeowners also, because, maybe they don't deserve control of their property taxes if we as renters don't deserve control of our rents. But this caller seems to have forgotten that one of the nice things about Proposition 13 is that it does help everybody. It helps renters. This is an unintended consequence that it limits a very regressive tax, and it's a tax that renters pay. We pay it through our rents to our landlords. They pay it on our behalf. We have to be very careful when we talk about getting rid of Proposition 13 or opposing it. All of the proposals that are on the table today that call for releasing the Proposition 13 limit for commercial property owners would really hurt renters, because we, our landlords, would wind up with tax increases, and we would be the ones who would pay those ultimately.
Okay, I think this is a debate for another time.
Yeah.
That's fine. I'm glad you brought that point out.
Just wanted to say, other side of Proposition 13, there's some good and bad things about it.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And I think it comes into the rent control kinds of questions that we're talking about here with Deanza and all of these issues.
Yeah, I'm hoping we can get actually the head of the Berkeley Rent Control Board, former head, to come down and chair a forum on this issue. Anybody's interested in that, give me a call at 423-HUFF. Thanks, Paul.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Well, another subject I've been covering in a desultory manner is the attack on medical marijuana by the feds and, of course, by our own Santa Cruz City Council, which has been trying to criminalize all the clubs in town except WHAM, which has a very small membership, and so essentially 90% of the medical marijuana patients have to look for their stuff elsewhere. Here's a quick call. Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Hi, Robert. This is Jane.
Hi, Jane.
Hi. I live out at Deanza, and I think I have a perspective that's a little different than what's been put out mostly. I haven't listened to most of your show this morning,
okay. But
thought I would call in.
Please.
I'm an advocate for rent control as a principal, but what I see in this town, and I see it ultimately through various bumblings or whatever, but reflected in the city council, is the city is not for rent control. I guess there's not support all the way up through the city, through most of the city, for the idea of rent control. And I think that that's also true here at Deanza, that people want cheap rent, but they don't necessarily want the principle of rent control. I think that it's equity that speaks, whether it's in Deanza or out of Deanza, and I find it disturbing.
Can you clarify what the difference is between wanting cheap rent and not wanting rent control?
Okay, you want it for yourself. You want a low rent for yourself, but you're not for the idea of rent control as a principle to be enacted as an ordinance or as a law or as a principle.
Why do you say that you think the city of Santa Cruz isn't interested, although, I mean, we've heard Mike Rotkin endlessly claim that he gave up in 1982 and all that, but I mean, have you seen any new surveys or analyses that indicate that the city isn't interested?
No, but talking to people and the kinds of things that are written into the editor, what I heard from residents before I moved out here in terms of what the important issues were. No, so I can't say, oh, no, there hasn't been, I don't have any survey results. But my strong sense is that if a rent control ordinance were on the ballot, if it could even get to ballot, it would be opposed.
Well, I know that activist Bob LaMonica was circulating just an advisory rent control proposal for the city council, which I believe was the city, which I supported. Do you remember how many signatures that got or where?
No.
Because I know that some of that has to do with lack of having enough people to carry those petitions. And for example, when you have enough people, and as well as professional signature gatherers, you can see with a referendum, you can get something pretty fast.
Well, be that as it may, we have different opinions on that. When I've been up at Sacramento a couple times through my job and have had opportunities to speak to assembly people, and you just raise the issue of rent control and they run backwards. You raise it at my union meeting and there are union people that say, oh no, we need equity. So that's my perspective, is that that's the general tenor here in this town as well as throughout the state.
Clarify what you, for those of us who aren't sophisticated, what you mean by equity.
Okay, what I mean is you buy into a house, you've got a bunch of capital that through paying your mortgage, and out here at De Anza, you know, you pay whatever the price is to get into the park to be able to be here, whatever the former owner is selling for. And then you have this big hunk of capital that you want to either maintain, or usually you want it to grow so that you can sell for more than you bought in for, or at least maintain that many thousands of dollars so that you can buy in somewhere else, so that you can pass it on to your heirs, so that you can have it whatever use you need it for.
What's going to be the consequence? I mean, have you signed this referendum yourself?
No.
So you are opposed to it?
Yes.
Do you think that there are many people who are opposed to it in De Anza? And if so, how many would you suspect are?
Okay. I don't think many are, except that now that there's the sense that the lease, we would lose everything, lose the lease, which does guarantee low rent for as long as you're here. Well, and I'm a rather young resident here. I would be 90 when the 34-year lease were up. But people are starting, some neighbors of mine, that's what I know, are starting to feel a little queasy, thinking, well, we could lose everything here, which is possible.
And explain to us how that would happen.
Okay, losing everything would be if the lease were gone and the city goes back into litigation. MHC does own this property. They are the owners. And there'll be no lease. The rent could be raised astronomically, and people would not be able to afford to stay here.
What about the current rent control law, though?
Well, it's my understanding that has been rescinded.
It is rescinded, but if the referendum is turned in, then that suspends the rescission, so the law stays on the books until it's either rescinded by the city council or voted up or down by the voters.
Right, right. So, well, but it's this tremendously expensive litigation.
Mm-hmm.
It seems that the law was not written to be able to withstand the onslaught of this mega power with their attorneys and deep pockets to fight it. And it doesn't seem very hopeful that it would be able, that the city would come out able to prevail in lawsuits. That's not what the city seems to think, and I haven't heard anyone give an opinion that seemed viable that the city would be able to prevail.
Well, my problem is, you know, I don't understand clearly the issues of, and I don't think it's been explained clearly in a public way by the city staff or by the city council or by the De Anza people, frankly, for that matter, what exactly the exact legal issues are that are involved in this lawsuit, and it would give us an opportunity to independently decide what the chances are of the De Anza or MHC prevailing. That's the problem I have. Do you have any
Well, that is a problem. I've just heard and read that it's multifaceted. But it's not that, I mean, the petition is being circulated saying, sign this so that people at De Anza can stay in their homes. And that is, I don't think, an appropriate thing to say about in terms of signing this referendum.
It assumes, I guess it says, sign this and assuming that the court. See, I mean, I've heard different things. I've heard at one point that that the MHC may prevail on a couple of the equity on a couple of the houses. Maybe some damages were lost on a couple of the houses that were sold without proper oversight.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how much this would be, but then I've heard alternately that there's going to be a challenge to the facial rent control law, but I don't know on what grounds that would be, whether it's been successful in other jurisdictions. It seemed to me that this kind of elementary analysis is what the city council owes to the tenants of De Anza, or one might even say that the tenants organization should get some attorney to provide an analysis of the pros and cons of the lawsuit so we can all kind of step out of the darkness here. The problem that the reason I support the referendum at the moment is because I think without the referendum, you have an imposed settlement which pretty much, when you say it, it certainly doesn't, you might, some say, well, it's real estate speculation here, you're destroying people's ability to speculate and get, money times what they invested, but didn't the rent control law, in essence, put a cap on what you could speculate on in the De Anza? You, in essence, kind of only, you couldn't sell your house for much more than you paid for it, except in whatever the accrued expenses and what you put into it, right?
Yes, but people did buy into here at many, many times worth what the actual mobile home is worth. They bought in, giving the whoever they bought from this big hunk of capital in order for the right to live here, because there was rent control. So there's still this hunk of money that they want, people want to get back.
Were you saying let's suppose the referendum was not filed and the settlement went through, as it will go through if the referendum is not filed,
right,
or inadequate numbers of signatures. And for some reason, let's suppose you have a catastrophic illness.
Right.
You think you can borrow any money on your trailer?
I could borrow the amount that that it costs, which is actually, it's worth about $100,000.
So you will be able to, and you think...
I would lose that amount of equity, but people moving in here in the last few years knew that was the chance we were taking.
So you're saying that the 34-year lease and the fact that MHC can raise the rents astronomically once the property gets to the... Yeah, once the ownership gets transferred, does not affect the existing equity in the trailer insofar as the...
Oh, no, it affects the equity that people put in it. So there, people will lose if they move, say, in less than 15 years. They'll lose.
What if
they'll lose, but it's not true that they can't sell their property for anything. They can sell it for what the actual trailer is worth. But
which would be like $100,000?
$100,000, or if it's an older one, maybe $70,000. But people paid maybe two to three times to four times, depending if you're out on the ocean, many times that, for the right to be there.
So you're saying that it's not, I mean, my understanding, and I'm now being corrected, is that if some people are saying the trailers will be worth, in essence, next to nothing.
That just doesn't make sense to me. I mean, the trailers, what MHC is wanting, and to be honest, it makes sense to me in this capitalist world, is that they want to be able to have the price that people pay to live in this gorgeous spot. I mean, De Anza is on a prime piece of property, especially the ones right out on the coast. Not many people get the opportunity to live there, and that's why people have paid more than the value of the trailer for the right to move in here. It's just that MHC has not gotten that money. But you come back around to it. People do say, and that's what I hear in it, it seems disingenuous to me, that they would get nothing for it. No, that's not true. But you just wouldn't get the amount that there would be a loss in equity. But you still can sell your trailer to someone who's willing to pay the rent. Now, the thing is, the rent, at least the back part of the trailer, of the trailer park, which is where I live, are reasonable. If you think about that we're living here near the coast, and it's not $1,500, I've been told it's like $1,250 that the rent would be raised to per month.
And what is it currently?
$550.
So
for me, I happen to be in a situation where I think that the people before me were in rent control, and I signed right on to rent control. There wasn't a lapse.
Right. Most of the people did sign on to rent control.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the thing is, if you take the higher rent and you spread that over, say, 15 years, well, there you've got that extra amount of money that people paid to the former owner instead of to MHC for the right to move in. Do you follow?
Yeah, I think I do. I thought there was a cap on what they could charge. So.
Well, if there's rent control,
right?
If there is the rent control, then if it's and in a rent control property, I would be capped. And now the city is on to the problems they had in following the sale of these, because it's not real property.
Weren't almost all the trailers capped? Aren't we talking about the trailers?
No, I'm not sure if it's almost all, because people do own these as second homes. I'd say the majority are capped, but they're capped at the current level now, which is a largely inflated value for the actual mobile home.
Uh-huh.
Like, what I paid to get in here is more than twice what the actual home is worth.
And you would lose that, in essence.
I would lose that difference.
Right.
Yes. Uh-huh. You know, and who wants to lose?
Right.
But it's not that it's worth nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also that, well, the whole situation got out of control in several ways. I mean, I wish that the city council did have an ordinance that was foolproof. I don't think they intended to have it not be foolproof. But I also wish that in the past, before I came here, people weren't equity happy and didn't see that they think that they own this property out here. I feel like a lot of the residents feel that it's their land, their right to have the view, when, I mean, I wish it were so, but the land belongs to MHC.
Have you presented this point of view in any public meetings with the ends of people?
No.
Have you felt afraid to do so?
No, I feel like I'm too busy with my job. Unfortunately, I either do my job
move onto the streets.
Well, maybe move out of town.
Move out of town.
Maybe move out of town.
I see. Mm-hmm. Well, I appreciate your moderating my hyperbolic rhetoric here, and I guess what I'd like to hear from other De Anza folks as to whether
as far as the services go,
yeah.
You know, when there are three main services of the mental health system, and that's the psychiatric drugs, restraints, and electroshock. And, you know, the people who really work in the field really think that they're doing well by
wait a minute, Jane. Are any of these subjects being discussed at this conference? I mean,
I don't know. It's going to be held from 8 in the morning to 5 p.m.
And where is it going to be held?
The Coconut Grove.
And that's down on the boardwalk?
Right.
You know, I mean, it would seem to me that this might be a nice place to do a counter demonstration of any
thing. We are planning one, and we're hoping to get other groups such as. You know, any other group that's interested in social rights.
Huff members are interested. I mean, at the meeting on Friday, Huff members said they wanted to be a part of it. And
Good. I'd like anybody to call me at 475-7904.
475-7904. And when do you think this protest will start, and where will it be?
We hope to cover the whole day. I mean, depending on how many people are.
Huh.
And there will be things passed out from the Scientologists, who put out wonderful posters on the facts that we're trying to get across to the to the general public.
Well, I've always said the Scientologists kind of resent the competition from the psychiatrists. They want to do the brainwashing.
No. Since the late 60s, they've been putting out information that's telling the truth about the treatment of mental health systems, just like in Mad America. And what they do to the research specimens, the human research specimens, is crimes against humanity, and they're going on right now. And I hope that, you know, like people in PETA, P-E-T-A, ethical treatment of animals, well, the most unethical treatment of humans is occurring right now at Dominican, 7th Avenue, and, you know, who happens to be a client of the mental health system.
Do you have literature about these local abuses that you're going to be handing out?
I sure do.